assume now that I did manage to move that shaft by a 16th of an inch to the north, the upper end of it. That means the white paint is now moved, let me pick a number, half an inch further away from the ground. You got that picture?
Yes, I did.
Now let me go back to the case where the wheel is spinning. But at the instant that I pushed on that shaft, I did it with a pulse of energy. The white stem was due south at that instant. I managed to accelerate it vertically. Because I pushed on the shaft to the north, the white stem, which is trying to raise itself a half inch off, further off the ground, I have given it a vertical velocity upward. The white stem, because of the pulse of energy I pushed to the north on the shaft, the stem with the white paint, which was south at that instant, is now accelerating upward. Have you got that picture, John?
Yes, I do.
Okay. It's accelerating upward. A fraction of a second later, because the wheel is rotating, the white stem that is accelerating upward is now at the 9 o'clock position. It's now to the west, and it has been accelerating upward. Have you got that picture? Go ahead.
Yes, just like the top. It has moved to the west because it is rotating clockwise.
So I have created an upward acceleration of that white stem by giving it a pulse of energy to the shaft to the north. The white stem started accelerating upward. A fraction of a second later, the stem that's accelerating upward is now to the west at the 9 o'clock position. Because that position at 9 o'clock is accelerating upward, you can see now why the shaft, with the pulse of energy to the north, the shaft moves to the east. Because that chunk of mass at the perimeter, I've accelerated it upward, and that upward accelerating mass now is to the west, and it's still going up, therefore the shaft is moving to the east because of it's continuously connected. The shaft is through the bearings connected to that wheel, and that portion of the wheel to the west, to the 9 o'clock position, is accelerating upward. You can see now why when I push to the north, it responds at right angles and moves to the east. Does that make some more sense? I wonder if it's ever been explained to you that way, John. K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Excellent explanation. Crystal clear. It shows you the action of those moments and how the inertia causes that to happen.
Now, I got two other questions to ask you about this example. That was what happens when I push the shaft to the north. It responds to the east when it's spinning clockwise. What do you guess will happen if my bicycle wheel was spinning counterclockwise and I repeat the experiment? Over to you, John.
The direction should be exactly 180 degrees. Opposite.
Okay, I'm pushing the shaft to the north. What's the shaft going to do?
You're going to have it dip at the west.
You've got it. Now, here's the next step. I'm spinning that wheel faster and faster and faster. When I do that, each time I give a pulse of energy on that shaft toward the north, and I happen to time it just for my understanding, when the white piece of paint is to the south, and I'm trying to accelerate it upward, the white piece of paint, because I'm moving the shaft to the north, assume now that the wheel is spinning not one revolution per second, but 1,000 revolutions per second. 1,000 times per second during my pulse of energy, I'm trying to move the shaft upward when it's to the south. The stem, the white paint, is trying to move upward every time it's to the south. It's trying to move down every time it's to the north. And I'm doing that action cyclically. So during my pulse of energy, moving the shaft to the north, as the wheel spins faster and faster, I'm attempting to take that exact same chunk of mass with the white paint and move it upward on one half of the turn, move it downward on the other half of the turn, and I'm doing those motions faster and faster as I spin the wheel faster and faster. Therefore, I sense what feels like greater stiffness. I'm trying to accelerate this mass more and more frequently for the same amount of movement of the shaft. As I spin that wheel fast enough, it eventually becomes so stiff because I'm trying to move that mass up at 6 o'clock and down at 12 o'clock, I'm trying to do it so many times, so rapidly, that it feels to me like I can no longer move the shaft. Do you see why the gyroscope becomes stiffer as I spin it fast? Over to you, John. KQRIW.
Yes, I do, Dick, and that means that the pulses would have to be of shorter duration and of much higher amplitude to achieve the same thing you did at the 1 RPM.
Exactly what is happening in NMR, and I have a comment on that.
Yeah, but in order to make it simple, I made it look like I was giving pulses of energy, because the pulse of energy when the white stem is at the south or at 6 o'clock, and the pulse of energy when the white stem is at 12 o'clock makes some sense. There's nothing magic in this case about doing it with a pulse. I can do it with a continuous application of force. Even with the continuous application of force, every time the stem is south, I'm trying to move it up. Every time the stem is north, I'm trying to move it down. And I'm only analyzing the area of the wheel that I call stem, where the white paint is. The rest of the wheel, as it spins, is going through the 6 o'clock position and 12 o'clock position also. The whole darn mass around the perimeter of that wheel is doing this. For simplicity, I analyzed only that little chunk of mass around the white stem. But the whole damn wheel is doing it. So I can apply the force continuously, I can spin the wheel as fast as I like, and as I spin it fast enough, eventually I can't move it at all. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
I agree, Dick. That's a great analogy. And it explains the gyroscope a lot easier than it is to do it by observation, that's for sure.
Yeah, my guess is no one has ever explained a gyroscope or a child pop, which is really a gyroscope, that way. Have you ever been a little bit amazed in the past as to why it precesses? And have you ever had any difficulty in the past of figuring out which would be the direction of precession until tonight? Over to you, John.
I understand the reason why it precesses, but I did not analyze it the way you did and look at the reactions as you would try to move it. Although I've held the gyroscope in my hand, and I've also held a spinning bicycle higher in my hand and tried to change its attitude. Amazing how that works. And you're right, the faster it spins, much more difficult to change its attitude.
Now, to see if you understand how this all works, the experiment that I did was to connect two gyroscopes side by side with the shafts parallel to each other with a metal frame device that I made up. I took a bunch of coat hanger wire and I made a metal frame so two gyroscopes are held side by side. And I spin one gyroscope clockwise and I spin one gyroscope counterclockwise. And they both come down to a common point at the bottom. So I've now got a dual gyroscope, one spinning clockwise, one spinning counterclockwise. I spin them up, I set it perpendicular to the table, and I let go. Tell me, John, what you think happened.
I would think there's no precession because they would be canceling the effect.
Okay. I agree with you, there was no precession. Now, when I let go of these two gyroscopes, I'm spinning them very fast, one clockwise, one counterclockwise, and I let go. Yes, they do not precess. Tell me what else they might do.
They may not rotate either as a unit. They're rotating, of course, individually. They may not rotate.
I've got two gyroscopes. I've got one to the left of center, one to the right of center. They're both bound with this wire structure that won't allow them to move with reference to each other. And the bottom of the wire structure has a common point going down to the table, right in the middle of the two, so to speak. And I've set them up so that it would be a normal gyroscope that would normally precess. You guessed correctly that it doesn't precess. And I spin the two up, one clockwise and one counterclockwise, so they're eventually going to settle down to the table. One gyroscope all by itself probably took 60 seconds to settle down to the table. With the two of them, twice as much moments of inertia, in two separate opposite directions like that, what's your guess as to how long it takes to settle down to the table, John? Go ahead.
I would believe the same time.
If that was the answer, would I be asking this question? Because they were spinning at equal speed and opposite directions, believe it or not, the gyroscopic action disappeared. It falls straight over to the table.
You know, there's a comment on this type of bar dribble that I'm over in Mars. Exactly, I believe the family, I think, you know, would like to compare with you.
Okay, that was a double. John, why don't you say what you just said again?
I understand. I did not think of that. You're right. It falls over. No gyroscopic action. So I guess we couldn't use a pair of them tied together like that for guidance systems.
Yeah, the next step was, let's assume now that I'm smart enough to spin them all clockwise. And I put one of them with the axis to the north along the... I got an XYZ. I've got your normal... cube type, what do you call it? Orthogonal reference system. X, Y, and Z all at right angles to each other. One gyroscope, the axis is to the X axis, parallel to X axis. One gyroscope is parallel to the Y axis. Because they're at right angles to each other and held together with a common frame, and they spin the two up, there is now no direction that I can move that frame. That frame is now rigid in every possible direction. Ordinarily, when you take the frame around a gyroscope, if my gyroscope is spinning clockwise with the axis parallel to Z, I can take the outer frame and I can still rotate it around the X axis. In other words, if I had a rod sticking out of it to the X axis, I could move that rod around so it's parallel to the Y axis while the tap is spinning to the Z axis. So I'm free in at least one of the planes of motion when I have a single gyroscope. But if I've got a pair of gyroscopes connected together, one parallel to the x-axis, one parallel to the y-axis...
Oh, that's fully understood, Dick, because I had a gyro pack for my Leica camera, which had two gyros in it that would spin up to 50,000 RPMs. Could not move that camera, very difficult. I also had a three-axis one. For the go axis, and you're right, they work perfectly.
There's a catch. I've got one gyroscope parallel to X, the axis, and one gyroscope, the axis is parallel to Y. And although that's a thoroughly rigid structure, I can't move it around X, because if I try to rotate it around X, the Y gyroscope says, no, you're not going to do that. I try to move it around Y, the X gyroscope says you're not going to do that. If I try to rotate it around Z, the X and the Y gyroscope says, no, you're not going to do that. It's a thoroughly rigid structure with two gyroscopes. But I decide to make it even more rigid. I add a third gyroscope in the Z axis. Each one, as I look down the axis toward the origin, is turning clockwise. I've now got three gyroscopes connected together with a common metal frame holding them together, and I spin up all three. Do you believe that's a more stable structure than when there were two gyroscopes? Over to you, John.
No, I do not, because the third gyroscope was a much more expensive package, and it didn't prove to be any better. Whether it was what they called a suspended shot or whether it was handheld, there was no difference in the photograph. So I don't believe the third axis improved it.
Oh, it's a lot worse than that. With two gyroscopes, you've got a structure that is stable. With three gyroscopes, it is definitely unstable. I watched the astronauts on the space shuttle with these, let me call them pop gyroscopes. In other words, they've got these gyroscopes that are connected to what looks like pop beads, and they can connect them together with a pop structure. And so they could put two of them together and spin them up, and it was a very stable structure. They tried. It was floating in space, in free space, in front of them, and they were pushing it with their fingers, and they couldn't change the orientation when there were two. When they popped three of them together and spun them up, guess what happened in free space?
It rotated in the direction of the third, added one.
A good guess, no. If I created a vector in space, plus one X, plus one Y, plus one Z. That would be a rod coming out of the corner, so to speak. If the X, Y, and Z were the upper corner of your room, where your the two walls of the room meet the ceiling. I could call that the X, Y, and Z axis. If I now held a broom handle at the corner of the upper corner of the room so that it's equally angled from each of those three axes, can you picture the way that broom handle would be? Plus one X, plus one Y, plus one Z. Over to you, John.
Yes, I can. I can understand that.
The whole structure started rotating around the plus one X, plus one Y, plus one Z vector. And the structure was converting its rotational kinetic energy of the individual gyroscopes into translational rotational energy of the gyroscopes around that axis. He sat there and watched that axis. He watched that whole triple gyroscope mechanism spin up faster and faster, and the three of them flew apart. The pop beads came apart because they started moving around that common axis so rapidly. What's really happening is that if I create a precession of the x-axis, the y and the z respond in such a way that everything starts rotating around that common axis that I told you, plus one x, plus one y, plus one z. So the precession of any one of the gyroscopes, or any pair of them, makes it respond around that common axis. And pretty soon the whole thing spins so rapidly in translation that it flies apart. Over to you, John. Funny thing to watch when the astronauts did that. K2RIW.
So it was rotating around the apex. Is that what you're saying?
If you call the plus one X, plus one Y, plus one Z, that common vector, the apex, you're absolutely right. It continuously spun faster and faster because by the combination of the precessions and the interactions between them, it was converting all of the rotational kinetic energy of each individual gyroscope into the translational energy around that common axis. And eventually it flew apart. Over to you, John.
So it was the algebraic sum of their vectors that caused that rotation.
Well, another way of looking at it is that when I have one gyroscope of X and one gyroscope of Y, each one creates the right amount of stability, but they are decoupled from each other. When I add the third gyroscope along Z, all three are now coupled to each other in a complicated way, whereas the precession of any one creates the precession reaction of the other, and the net result is that the whole thing will spin around that common axis. What did you call that common axis? You gave it a word and I forgot it. Go ahead.
The apex. So in other words, if I'm viewing this right, we had basically chaos about that axis. But that apex drew a line through it. Would that precess?
Very good guess. The answer is no. And there's something else peculiar about it. When they first spun all three up, connect two together, everything's nice and stable, connected the third one, and very carefully let go of it, it was stable temporarily. When the smallest amount of perturbation comes along that tries to move the axis of that frame in any way, it responds by rotating around what you call the apex vector. As it begins to rotate around the apex vector, the rate of acceleration continuously increases. The smallest amount of disturbance started it to move around the apex. As long as you never disturbed it, it would look like it's stable. An astronaut came along and touched it with his finger, very lightly, and he started the process. And it started rotating around what you call the apex vector. And once it started doing that, any motion around the apex vector creates more precession of each individual gyroscope, which really increases the rate of rotation around the apex. There was no precession around apex. It just rotated faster and faster around the apex vector, and the rate of acceleration continuously increased until it flew apart. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, because I was wondering, I don't know how the gyroscopes were laid out in the three gyroscope package, but it must have worked apex as the pointing to keep it steady. But I noticed that the two gyroscopic package did a beautiful job and was very steady, very difficult to move. But that's interesting that any slight perturbation caused that thing to go into chaos. And actually what was happening was it was becoming a monogyroscopic device within itself.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what it was doing. So you can put three gyroscopes into your camera if you want to. They better not be coupled to each other mechanically. If each one has independent gimbals and independent XY shaft encoders, with the right kind of a computer program, you can make a stable network. But you do not mechanically couple those shafts to each other by way of the frame. And since two gyroscopes gives you all the stability you need, I'm not convinced the third one buys you anything. But if there is a third one, it better be mechanically decoupled. Over to you, John.
Yeah, and I don't understand how they can do that with three and have them mechanically isolated. The two I can understand, and that would work fine, but how they incorporated a third, which to me was a total waste of money. No improvement noticed at all. And even I was working with very large negatives, doing very large blow-ups around 4 foot by 4 foot in the lab in the dark room. And I saw no difference at all.
You could have a gimbal mechanism around each individual gyroscope with shaft encoders that tells you the frame has attempted to rotate itself. Let's assume now that gyroscope number one is along the x-axis, and the way the gimbals are with their two individual shaft encoders, one of them is measuring whether or not you created a rotation around Y or around Z, and the shaft encoder tells you you've attempted to do that. But the gyroscope always stays in the x-axis in inertial space. You could do that. And you could do that again with... And by the way, if you did that, there's one direction in which the gyroscope... Let me think now. Yeah. With only an x-gyroscope, any rotation of the frame around the x-axis you cannot send, because the gyroscope is already rotating very rapidly around x. But once you add the second gyroscope around Y, I think you know everything. And so somebody must have advertised the three gyroscope structure because it sounded like it's better. And it doesn't surprise me that you found out it wasn't better. I guarantee that third gyroscope was not mechanically connected to the first two. And I don't think it was buying you anything. Over to you, John. KQRW.
You're probably right. It's probably either some forethought that was in error or just a sales gimmick. But, you know, another thing, as far as I know, there were no encoders involved. These were just mechanical gyros that held it rigid just by their spinning. I know that was the fact with the two-pack. Did a very good job, but I don't think there was any sophisticated encoding involved at all. They just went up to their high RPMs, put them on a battery, spun them up. It was attached to the camera. It was a pretty heavy item, but took steady shots.
Comment. John, before the comment, John, what was that camera intended to measure? Very steady pictures of the horizon, or was this some kind of a vertical camera that was taking pictures of something that was on the table? Over to you, John.
In any event where we're using the high-speed film at low speeds, you would always have some kind of blurring, especially with, you know, when you got up near 200 millimeters, it got a little tough to be handheld. You needed no tripod at all with this. It worked beautifully.
So this was a handheld 200-millimeter telescopic lens, 35-millimeter camera, and it took pictures that had no blur. Go ahead.
Absolutely. No blur at all, and I've used it up to 600-millimeter.
What brand name is that thing, and how many dollars?
Leica, and everything with them is thousands.
Doesn't surprise me. Our person with comment, start off with your name and call in, and go right ahead with your comment.
My name is Nifan. My call is KB2JKW. I have just a really quick question and a comment. I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. The gyros are used to like stabilize the camera, right? Not to sense any motion. Obviously, is that correct?
Correct.
So, in that case, wouldn't you need three to stabilize it in every facing the direction. Like, in other words, you're holding the camera, looking at it from behind. You have, like, an up and down motion. You can look up, you can look down, you can look right, you can look left. You need two gyros for that, I would think. And then pop, thinking maybe for the twisting. Like, in other words, if you raise the right side of the camera up and lower the left side of the camera up, or vice versa, like, wouldn't you need three gyros to stabilize it in all three of those axes or whatever?
Nippon, you've used good common sense when you said you need three. The answer is you only need two. Believe it or not, it'll take you a while to study that. Two gyroscopes at right angles stabilizes you in every possible direction of rotation. KB2JKW, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Very good. I think I just realized why. Possibly because if you push, like, let's say you push in one direction, the other gyro, you know, opposite, you know, like the one that would counteract the motion of the direction you're pushing it, the other gyro would also come into effect. And I see. I think I understand why. That's interesting, though. Stop for letting me break in there. Let me let it drop for 1 sec. And I was also going to say, it actually helped me, all this talk about perception helped me to understand more actually about how a helicopter works, because I have, like, a little radio control helicopter. And what actually happens is, like, as the blade is spinning, like, if it's straight and level, if you want to push the nose down, like, the shaft is spinning from the top clockwise, let's say, the blades, like, change pitch angle. If you want to nose down and move forward, they change pitch angle when they're at the side of the helicopter, where you would think, you know, because of precession, where you would think they would change when they're in front and back of the helicopter. As they're changing pitch every single time, they rotate, as, you know, when you push the control to make it go nose down.
Not true.
Now I understand completely why that happens, why that is, and how it all works. So, cool. Thank you, guys. And Dick, back to you. This is KB2JKW. I'd
like to make a comment before the time expires.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, the interesting fact that put my attention to NMR was that the Institute of Exploratory Research for U.S. Army, they made the experiment, which was studied a single crystal of planar hexagonal ferrite, which was made from barium, zinc, ferrite, and manganium. What happened is that the spin echo spectrum at about 2 Kelvin shows that the broad line extending from the 300 to 470 megahertz, which was identified as a manganium ions, start to replace iron. And the octatetral size of two relatively narrow lines at 555 megahertz to 585 megahertz, which were identified as the manganium ions, start to replace zinc. And these two types of that tetrahedral sites occurs in the structure. So we're talking about influence of the energy from the radio wave. The energy the frequency starting to replace a physical structure in within the ferrite. Back to you.
So you're saying by putting a radio wave on the outside of some reasonable magnitude, the molecular structure within the ferrite was being changed, where one ion or one kind of atom of one material was changing for another atom of another material? It sounded like that's what you're saying. It sounds like transmutation, and I'm having a little trouble with that one. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to go through the nuclear magnetic resonance in order for me to come to the point but obviously we don't have a time for that. The Hubble fine fields of and the temperature dependencies of the resonance frequencies for the manganium ions on the two types of tetrahydrocytes can be explained in terms of the different electronic environment of two sides. That's why the example with what you were discussing about the gyro mechanism was one of the parts for me to get into that. But yes, that's what is happening. You have a copy of that abstract. Back to you.
When that transition is taking place, were these materials in the molten state, were they heated, or were they in the crystalline solid state when this transition is taking place? Go ahead.
We're talking about the temperature of 2 kelvins. There is no way for them to be in molten state.
I agree with that. So while they're at 2 degrees Kelvin, you're saying a molecular change is taking place by way of external radio signal. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct.
Wow. Boy, that's a tough one to swallow, isn't it?
That's why I was trying to buy the time. But we change the subject, and what I believe we should do is come back next week to that and go through the rest of the NMR.
You apparently have some understanding, and I'm pretty sure I do not. Do you have a, John, from what you've been hearing tonight, do you have a warm, fuzzy feeling as to how nuclear magnetic resonance imaging or magnetic resonance imaging, how that imaging process takes place? Is that clear to you, John? Because it's not yet very clear to me. KC2WGB, K2RIW?
I basically have the same opinion you do. I do not have enough evidence, or I have not read enough about it. I understand very little about it, so I don't know how that's produced.
Well, what I was trying to say, since we have a few minutes left, we considered what happened to Lymer precession of the magnetization when it's viewed in the rotating frame. In the fixed frame, the precession of, let's say, omega zero, if we choose the rotating frame, frequency, in the rotating frame, the magnetization will appear not to move. In the apparent Lymer frequency, of apparent Lymer frequency. So if we choose the rotating frame to be at Lymer frequency, then the offset...
Freedom Tower, the biggest buildings, controlled by the Port Authority, and everything you do, you do something, then you take 5 steps backwards, and you do it again, and you take 2 steps backwards, and then you do it again, and you take 8 steps backwards, until they decide it. So they decide that, oh, you know, okay, we should have did it the way you guys did it.
The other three towers are controlled by people other than the Port Authority? I thought the whole property was controlled by them.
Majority of the property is, but Tower 4 is Silverstein's building.
Tower 4 is where the Deutsche Bank used to be?
Negative. Deutsche Bank's an empty hole right now. The Tower 4 is on the southeast corner of the 19 acres.
Okay. I'm not that familiar with the footprint of the whole area. What is it, the memorial's right dead center of the whole thing, and they got towers on the four corners?
Towers on three corners, and then the Deutsche Bank thing, whatever they do with that. And, yes, the memorial's in dead center with the two reflecting walls of the two footprints of the old towers. And then underneath that, in the lower level, will be the 9/11 Museum and Memorial. So, and then center between the two pools is what they call the hub. That's going to be the subway that goes to the memorial. And all the other points, which goes to the other hub. No, that's the pavilion, which connects to the hub, which will have, 13 subway lines and path trains and this and that and everything else. So, it's quite the tremendous job site. Anyway, Gary, I'm waiting here. Gonna pull into the parking garage, so I will catch you later. Have a safe ride in. And to ZDB, W2-8-2-8-73, I'm clear.
Maybe I'll catch you on the return trip, John. And to ZDB, clear and listening.
Somebody.
What's the matter, Stevie?
And to ZDP here.
I thought the Rubito was sunk. This came to UN. UN Mobile. Not Marine Mobile. So, how did you make out? Any seepage?
Not that I'm aware of. I take it your house was moist, if you're worried about that?
Well, I had some seepage. But, considering what came down, not too bad.
Roof, basement, what?
The basement. But I was able to contain it, so it wasn't too terrible. And I don't know how much you got, but according to my rain gauge, we got between 5.5 and 6 inches by me. I realized it was heavier in certain areas, but that was enough for me.
I was out at my brother's house a good part of the day, which is out in Suffolk County. So, I have no idea how much we got.
How was it getting around yesterday?
Roads were, shall we say, puddly.
Puddly, you say?
Yeah, I definitely washed the undercarriage of the car.
Okay, not a bad thing. Well, I was on call this weekend, so I kind of stayed local. I worked on the house on Saturday and then inside yesterday, so got a lot off the to-do list. So that's a good thing. Wasn't a total waste, and I didn't sit around like a couch potato all day counting the raindrops.
Sunny boy back from Florida yet?
That's a negatory, good buddy. Comes back on Thursday.
Has he hinted as to what kind of vehicle he's going to be shopping for?
Yeah, I thought we went through all this already. He's looking at a Subaru. Got his heart set on.
This way he'll be able to say whoop-de-doo for my Subaru. I assume you're talking about new.
I think it's going to be a, you know, new used type.
Oh, so he's going to be going around the dealers to check out what he can get. That's what came back from the lease, probably.
Right. But I'll know more on Thursday. I think he's supposed to fly up in the morning, so he'll probably be back by the afternoon. Which means I have to get more food in the house. I tell you, I'd save money when he was gone.
Yeah, well, one-third less people in the house, and at his age, that's at least one-third less food in the house.
This is true. So, my daughter wants to go camping, so I took off the end of the month. I tell you, this kind of rain we had, with where I go, that causes those flash floods. I'm glad I wasn't up there this weekend.
Are you the camper type camping like Richie? Or do you actually rough it and use a tent?
I am a tent person. Two tents. You know, for the 1 or 2 days, it's not too terrible. Could always be nicer if you did it all the time. That's good. I looked at a pop-up a few years ago. Somebody was going to give me one, because that's usually how it is. They usually end up sitting in somebody's driveway falling apart. So I was going to get one that was, that needed some work on it and utilize that, but that never materialized. There's much ado about nothing. You know the drill. And they make them really nice now, but they, you know, they cost money, and when they're not being used, people think that they still have that value of them, even though they're wrecks.
Oh, you got the other thing. It's a registered vehicle, so you have to have tags on it. And how much does it cost to have the, one of those things registered for using it once a year?
I don't know. It doesn't have a motor, so I would imagine it's like a trailer, maybe $35-$40. Much more comfy, though. You know, like I said, if you go a lot, my kids are kind of growing out of the age of doing that. But I was a stone-cold camper when I was younger. I was one of those tri-mountain hike, camp on top of the mountain types. Travel as light as you can. Had a good time with that.
Dehydrated food. Or did they have that when you were that age? Dehydrated food, the little white gas stove, single burner stove, all that stuff?
We had it. I would have loved to have one of these, you know, tents you could put up in 10 minutes. And you know how that goes if you ever hit a campsite when it's dark out.
Oh, yeah. Been there, done that. Even on the t-shirt.
Did you read the book and see the movie?
Yeah, I remember the very first time I went camping. This was before I had even considered joining the Scouts. My kids were both very young. Joined friends who had a campsite out at Hither Hills. And I borrowed someone's tent, rolled up to the campsite, and the first thing I did was start putting up that tent and stowing the gear inside. And my friend said, what are you wasting your time for? Come on down to the beach. I said, I want to get the tent up first. Good thing I did. The fog rolled in and everything was getting wet. My stuff was dry.
Yeah. We used to do some mountain camping where we would get snow at night. That was kind of cool. Well, you walk in and snow during the day, and that was in Vermont, White Forest. That was actually pretty neat. It was my first adventure with snowshoes and that kind of stuff. I really didn't camp on Long Island that much. It was always upstate, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont. Always upstate somewhere, mountainous type stuff.
So it's the lightweight tent, backpack. The heaviest thing he carried was the water.
Yep. I think when I was still young, I was starting to carry some radio gear. No, it wasn't as miniaturized as it is now. But it was more in the way of the early HT type stuff, which were pretty big back then by today's standards. And maybe some, you know, rudimentary snap together vertical, something like that. But that was aluminum, that wasn't too bad. You had a cot instead of like a bedroll. You had one of those aluminum cots that folds up. That was the cat's meow, that you were actually off the ground. But most of us weren't. We had the roll-up foam beddings, if you recall. And I tell you, we didn't have all the creature comforts that they have today. And you know how it is today. It's a whole different ball of wax. But we still had a good time.
Now, the problem with a lot of those camp beds, the fold-ups, if you're not careful with what you buy, you end up poking holes in the floor of the tent. So, you gotta be careful.
It's true. Did I tell you the story where I got bit by a snake on a camping, hiking adventure?
No, you never did.
Oh, I saw some of these guys there. I got bit by a snake. I got bit by a timber rattler. Non-poisonous. Pretty, you know, they could be nasty, but non-poisonous, so that was exciting.
Leg, arm, foot, hand, where'd you get bit?
I can't tell you that.
Got you while you were sitting or squatting, huh?
It was a leg shot. It was, like in the upper ankle area. As I recall, I think I stepped on it. I was one of those guys that was always, you know, the point man. I had my big walking stick and I would kick up the snakes. Well, I jumped over a log and I think I stepped on it.
Snakes don't like to be stepped on.
No, they also don't like to let go once they're on you. So that was kind of wild. You know, and as a kid, the whole sight of it causes terror. But I think I tried to, like, kick it off, like, almost like you were kicking a football. I was swinging my leg around and it flew off. And then the counselors that I was with ran after it to see what it was. See if I was going to need some kind of attention, which I think was pretty nice of them, and that's when that was determined. So that was in the Catskills by Slide Mountain.
How old were you and how old were the counselors?
The counselors were about 25 years old, and I was, I'm going to say, 13, 14-ish.
They didn't start "you're gonna die" routine?
Oh, of course they did. Of course they did. Yeah. You're up on a mountain. This is not the days where you have a cell phone or, as I said, even a piece of radio equipment if you were lucky enough to have it. You get the check-in stations at certain elevations, and those huts that they built did have first aid equipment that you could use, so I think they ran down to the next closest one and made a call to the park ranger and determined that it was a non-poisonous snake and that I didn't need attention. Unless I needed, then they would have flown in and taken me off the mountain, but they didn't. They patched me up, made fun of me, and I toughed it out. Today it would have probably been a major lawsuit.
Yeah, probably.
My sonny boy got bit by a snake. I'm going to sue you for $3 million.
Right. $3 million in, what is it, trauma? Yeah. Post-stress trauma. It's crazy. I did get to meet the Rangers and went to their station, you know, which was like a, I think it was like one of those forest fire towers type stations, because I remember the tower that I had to go up, and then they checked me out, and spoke to a doctor over the radio and all that, and everything was all right, which, you know, was kind of heroic for me.
Well, now that we have completed the tale of woe of the snake bite, I will bid you adieu and relegate you to the loneliness of the airways, because I'm about to pull the plug and go Submariner. 7-3-10-2-ZDP.
All right, appreciate you listening to my boring story, and thanks for not throwing me off the repeater like you've been doing to everybody. 7-3 from GABY2NQN Mobile. Somebody.
Oh, Steve, KB2NQN, N2EO on the handy talkie. How's happening, Steve?
How you doing, Rich?
Okay, gotta press the button. It helps to press the button. How you doing, Steve? Everything is good here. Life is good. Had a lot of rain here in Whitestone yesterday. Came down like crazy. Hope everything is well with you, and I'm just finishing up breakfast. I'm going to feed the cat in a few minutes. Patty is still sleeping.
Okay, yes, we had quite a bit of precip out on the island. We had a little seepage in the basement. Did you have anything?
No, I don't think so. I got to look in the cellar portion, you know, the unfinished portion of the basement, but fortunately, I've never had that problem. Only in the last few years, a little bit of seepage. Actually, I did have a foundation. But I had a guy come in, a concrete guy, and he knew what he was doing. He was right where I was. He dug down and patched it, and everything was fine. So, all right, everything. Okay. Other than that, not much else is going on here.
All right, I'm glad to hear that you didn't have any problems. Like I said, I had some seepage. It wasn't terrible. I was able to contain it. And I got a lot of work done at the house this weekend. That was good. What was I just going to tell you? Oh, while I was working in the house, I did some listening in yesterday's AM carrier, and they had a small group on. I heard Hal was in there. A lot of noise, though. I guess because of the weather. A lot of noise. But I had that on for a little while before I put on some music and stuff, so that was nice. Everybody telling the same tale of woe.
Yeah, okay, Steve. Yeah, I gotta do some work on the Johnson Viking Ranger. I turned it on last week, and it's got a hum. I think an electrolytic went bad. You know, I rebuilt the whole thing, but some of the caps I used have gone bad, the new caps, and I don't know why they went bad. I've had this happen before. I gotta pull it off the shelf, and it's hard for me to move it myself, so I gotta get some help. Put it on the workbench. But I was doing some work yesterday on the 6-meter kilowatt. I've got it mostly done. I think I got to download some schematics off of the internet. You know, it's a converted SB220. I'm going to do that this morning. I'm going to download some portions of the manual. If I can't find them, Hal said he'll lend me a manual for a I rebuilt the whole thing. I converted it to 6. I rebuilt the power supply. I used the new boards from the filter caps, meter board, and all that stuff from I can't remember the name of your company. remember the name, but he's still alive.